Darius the Great is not okay, but I'm not the one who says so. That's the title of a young adult novel by Kansas City author Adib Karam. It's about a teenager who doesn't fit in. He's got this foreign-sounding name and dark skin in a school full of white kids who pick on him. He's been diagnosed with clinical depression, and the meds he's on have made him gain weight. His dad keeps pushing the salad bowl his way over dinner and giving him advice on how not to be a target. The two things Darius loves are hot tea and Star Trek. And even though the author is not exactly the character he writes about, they have a whole lot in common. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's show is a portrait session with Adib Karam. His book hits the shelves in August, and it's already getting a ton of national buzz. Actually, make that international buzz. Adib Karam, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
The story in this book is that you've got this kid, a depressed, awkward teenager, going on a sudden, unexpected trip to Iran, a place he's never been, to visit his grandparents who he's never met.
Right. It was kind of came from a place where I myself have actually never been to Iran. I was fortunate enough that I knew my grandparents because they emigrated to Vancouver, Canada. But since I saw them very infrequently, I had always felt very distant from them and yet very deeply connected in the way of all family as well. So I wanted to explore what it might have been like if they were in Iran.
Now, like I said, you and Darius have a few crucial things in common. You both grew up with one parent who's Persian and one born here in the U.S. Can you talk to me about that piece of it?
Yeah. My father is actually Iranian. He came here in the 70s to study. He went to both MU and KU, which I think is a very interesting combination.
And it's like he has a lot of conflict inside of him.
He truly does. And he met my mom and they fell in love. They toyed with the idea of moving to Iran to start a family. But when the Islamic Revolution happened, they kind of put the kibosh on that and stayed here in the States and raised me and my sister here.
What would be, from your perspective, like the short version of here's what happened in the Iranian Revolution for those who don't recall or are too young to recall?
Oh, my goodness. So the United States, as well as the United Kingdom and a number of Western powers, had been involved in some overt and some kind of clandestine attempts at influencing the government of Iran, sometimes with results that were essentially a net positive and oftentimes with results that were net negative. They deposed a prime minister that was fairly well-loved by the populace and installed the Shah, who was beloved by some segments but not by others. And eventually there was a revolution that deposed the Shah and installed an Islamic Republic. And when the United States offered, if I remember correctly, they offered medical aid to the Shah, who was suffering from cancer, the Iranian government wanted him returned to them, extradited basically, and then took the American embassy hostage. And that crisis lasted for 400-something days.
And so that was going on, and your parents thought, like, this is not a situation where moving back to Iran is the best option for us.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so you grew up in Kansas City, and your main character, like I said, Darius, he grows up feeling really like this misfit. Is that something that you also draw from experience on?
I definitely did feel awkward and out of place. And part of that is probably just my personality. I'm a little bit of a forceful personality. Even as a child, I was a little bossy, a little too big for my britches. I tend to be a bit nerdier and a bit.
So you were a nerd boss.
I was a nerd boss, and I tended to be a little more intellectual than a lot of my classmates. And granted, you know, when you're four, how intellectual can you be? But even so, I didn't always just want to, like, run around and have fun. I wanted to solve puzzles and do stuff like that. So compounded with that was the fact that I was at school with kids named, you know, Mike and Amber, and my name was Adib. And when you're 4 or 5 years old and you're still calling people dweebs, you can make a dweeb into a very nice nickname that lasted, I don't know, a good 8 years of traction out of that before we hit middle school and they realized there were better insults to use.
How old were you when you were writing this book?
Oh, I started writing it in 2015, which would have made me 31. I'm sorry, I mean 25. Well, 25 six times over.
You know what's kind of hard, I mean, for me to imagine about the way you write about that feeling of being a kid who's being picked on is that you really took me back to the way a kid feels those. I mean, there are some really cruel things that other kids do to this character, Darius, but there are also these like minor slights that feel huge to kids. And you took me back to what that feels like. It must have made a really profound impression on you.
It did. I think most authors of young adult fiction are of the opinion that no one ever really stops being a teenager at heart, especially in America, where we've built up the construct of teenagerness and the high school years as such a formative part. I think there are a lot of people that have parts of themselves stuck in those years.
And wait, can you say more about that?
Ooh. In what way?
Well, just what, first of all, the construct of teenagerness, and then second of all, like, how and why Americans in particular get stuck in it.
I don't know that I can talk much about the reasoning of it, but I do know that the concept of being a teenager as being in this transition from being a child to being an adult is relatively recent. If we lived, 150 years ago, we were expected to be an adult by the time you hit 15 or 16. If you were, say, nobility in Europe, you were probably married by age 13 or 14. If there are any historians listening, there's no need to correct me. I won't be able to hear it. And I'm not a historian, so I'm not sure at what point Americans constructed this idea of being a teenager, of that being the time of life when you're figuring out what's going on, who you want to be, when you're kind of rebellious, when you're hormonal, which granted is scientifically accurate, as your body's maturing. But also the idea of high school is very singular to America. I've read recently that teenagers in the United Kingdom, for instance, are expected to understand the workings of the American high school system because of the American cultural hegemony over so much of literature. Whereas if you ask a teenager in America how school works in England, like, they have no clue unless they've watched a lot of BBC or whatever.
Well, so this is an experience that it sounds like the way it went for you maybe shaped why you wanted to kind of go back and explore it through literature, and not just for a general readership, but specifically for an audience of teenagers.
For sure. I've heard it said that writing is one of the cheapest forms of therapy, and I'm sure I still have way more neuroses packed in there from my high school years, which were not, I would say generally they were more unpleasant for me. I was kind of at the lowest parts of my own life with depression. And I did have some really good friends, but I also was not terribly popular outside of my little cohort. And high school was just kind of miserable at times. And books were always a refuge to me. Granted, when I was in high school, I was reading lots of science fiction and fantasy, especially Star Trek novels, as well as Magic the Gathering novels, which were a thing back then. My friend had gotten me into that card game, which was really fun, and then a tremendous expenditure of resources, which I did thankfully break my addiction to later on. But I think it was my hope, one, to kind of dredge up and reconcile some of the things I felt about high school, and also to give kids today maybe a mirror or a window to see themselves or to see someone similar to them.
One of the running themes in the book is depression and mental health in general, how we deal with it personally and also like collectively. And you just referenced your own depression as a teenager. Is there something about the way that we deal with it collectively that you think makes it hard on people on that most intimate, most personal level?
I think there's a lot of things that we do wrong. One is that so often we refuse to acknowledge that mental illness is an illness, that it's treatable, and it's not something that people that deal with it can exactly just shrug off. They can't just, pull up their pants and cinch their belt and keep on walking if they're dealing with mental illness. And I also think we tend to sensationalize it. There's you know, a lot of people with mental illness do struggle with suicidal ideation. But that's not the entirety of mental illness, and depression is just one small segment of that. And so I feel like a lot of times people that are just living their lives with it and still leading fulfilling lives are not necessarily represented in media or in the collective consciousness. And that's something I wanted to explore as well, that you can deal with it and you can still have a fulfilling life.
Well, we're going to get into your experience in a minute, but I want you to read the passage where we learn that Darius isn't just a little bit of a misfit, but he's also struggling with clinical depression. This is right after we've learned that every night he and his dad watch Star Trek together.
Dad and I both took medication for depression. Aside from Star Trek, and not speaking Farsi, depression was pretty much the only thing we had in common. We took different medications, but we did see the same doctor, which I thought was kind of weird. I guess I was paranoid Dr. Howell would talk about me to my dad, even though I knew he wasn't supposed to do that kind of thing. And Dr. Howell was always honest with me, so I tried not to worry too much. I took my pills and gulped down the whole glass of water. Dad stood next to me, watching, like he was worried I was going to choke. He had this look on his face, the same disappointed look he had when I told him about how Fatty Bulger had replaced my bicycle seat with blue truck nuts. He was ashamed of me. He was ashamed of us. Ubermenches aren't supposed to need medication.
Okay, so first of all, explain the Ubermensch thing.
Darius's dad, Stephen Kellner, is a white American of, you know, mild Germanic extraction, and so Darius really looks up to his dad even though they don't get along, and he's always calling his dad the Ubermensch or the Superman, basically, because his dad just seems to be put together in good shape, successful career, and Darius just doesn't understand how he could ever be that way.
It's fascinating to me that Darius sees his dad that way in spite of having depression, in spite of his dad having depression, but he doesn't see himself that way. He doesn't kind of give himself that same kind of permission to be both, you know, doing well and having depression.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that the title, I think, resonates with a lot of people is that you can be okay and be not okay at the same time, and that he sees all these little pieces of himself, some good and some bad, and he only overwhelmingly sees the bad about himself. And that's part of living with depression, and I think also sometimes that's part of being a teenager and not being ready to embrace the things that make you unique and wonderful.
I mean, it was a poignant scene for me for a lot of reasons. That scene where the dad and the son are both taking their medication, it was poignant for me as a parent, which surprised me, but I knew right away from the way you described the way Stephen Kellner was looking at his son that what Darius was interpreting as shame was something else. And this is a misunderstanding that continues for most of the book.
Right. I once read, and I wish I could remember where, that part of being a teenager, part of being young, is a tendency to react to the perception of someone's behavior rather than reacting to the actuality of that behavior. And looking back kind of on my own growing up with my parents, that I would sort of construct a narrative in my mind and I would be reacting to that narrative instead of what my parents or other adults in my life were actually doing or saying to me. And I wanted to capture that, especially because of how often it can be colored by depression, as well as many other mental illnesses. But well, my own experience is just with depression.
Yeah, talk to me about how your parents responded to, well, first of all, about your diagnosis, and then how your parents responded to it.
Okay. Excuse me. Sorry. I was diagnosed, I think, when I was 12 or 13. I was just entering middle school, and my mother also deals with depression. It's actually run in that side of the family for a number of generations, sometimes treated and sometimes untreated. I did have some relatives that did commit suicide, which was pretty rough on the family. So my mother was kind of aware that it was something to look out for. And so when I started showing a lot of symptoms, when I started really struggling with school and becoming pretty withdrawn, she knew to seek help. And so I made the rounds to a lot of different permutations of medication, as well as doing several years of counseling, especially late middle school, early high school, and worked to basically get it under control.
I mean, did you have that experience of feeling like this was a source of shame for your parents, like the character does?
I would say, for the most part, no. My mom was very upfront in sharing with me what her own battle with it had been like. I feel like battle is a bad word, and we often act like it's a battle, and yet that's often the first thing that comes to mind. But just her life with it, how it's colored her life but hasn't inhibited her from living a full life. So she was always very upfront about it. It was always a little different with my dad. In Iran and in Iranian culture, mental illness is much more stigmatized than in American culture, and it's not something that's usually discussed. It's often seen as a sign of weakness or something that you should be able to just solve for yourself. And thankfully, he was always supportive, even if he didn't necessarily come from the frame of reference to always understand it.
There's a scene much later in the book where Darius is playing with kind of like a new friend, and his new friend becomes curious about his depression and wants to understand it. And this is an Iranian friend, a friend who has what someone like what you might sort of crassly call quote unquote real problems. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like bad things have happened to this guy's family. Like, he's struggling with really immediate kinds of concerns that the main character can't even imagine. And he feels so guilty that nothing bad has happened to him, and yet he feels so bad.
Mm-hmm. That is definitely part of that mindset. I think more so the perceived mindset, because I don't think Darius's friend sees it that way. I think he was just generally a nice guy and curious. But that is sometimes a text and sometimes a subtext of conversations that people have, not just in Iran, but even here in the United States with people who don't quite get what the deal is with mental illness.
Can you talk to me just a little bit more about that cultural difference and how you've experienced it?
Only to a certain extent. I've been very fortunate in that I haven't had to face a lot of unpleasantness from my family and from the Iranians I know. My family emigrated from Iran in stages after the revolution. My father was one of five children, and his grandparents and three of his siblings all moved to Vancouver. Their kids, my cousins, were either raised kind of half and half in Iran and Canada or predominantly raised in Canada. And so they had a much more Western idea of mental illness. And thankfully, I don't think I ever had to deal with any kind of direct prejudice on that front. I'm sure growing up, I may have dealt with microaggressions that I didn't register at the time or that I've since forgotten. But in talking to other Iranians or Iranian-Americans, children of the diaspora, I know others have had more struggles than I have. And actually, there were one of the steps in the editing process was when we had other readers read it to make sure cultural authenticity was preserved. And one of the readers was Iranian and mentioned that her own struggle had been quite different than mine as far as interacting with family regarding mental illness.
I'm Gina Kaufman talking to author Adib Karam about his young adult novel, Darius the Great Is Not Okay. When we come back, we'll hear more about the question of fitting in for kids who walk that line of having immigrant parents but grew up here with what sometimes feels like a secondhand connection to this other culture. This is a portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And in his new book, Darius the Great Is Not Okay, Kansas City author Adib Karam refers to some characters as, what is it, true Persians?
True Persians or fractional Persians.
Yeah. Explain that.
For me, growing up as the child of an Iranian-American and a white American, I often felt like I was a bit half and half. And I've spoken to lots of other children of multiple cultures, whether that be biracial or simply bicultural. And there's often a feeling of being torn between those, of always being not quite enough for one, but not enough for the other either. Some people, as they grow up, start to see themselves as not half and half, but whole and whole. And others might feel themselves to be none and none, that they're just never going to belong in either, and they have to sort of forge a third path for themselves.
I've heard of the term that there are cultures that refer to it not as half, but double, and I think that that's really a different mentality and very cool.
I have never heard that, but I love it already. That sounds awesome.
Well, how did that play out for you? I mean, in specific.
For me, growing up in Kansas City in a predominantly white school.
Where was this exactly?
I grew up in Gladstone. I went to Winnetonka High School, go Griffins. And I don't think, aside from my sister, that there were any other Iranians. No. There was one other half-Iranian in school with me. But for the most part, I think just for self-preservation growing up, even from a young age, I embraced as much of my Americanness as I could. I avoided talking about being Iranian. I kind of tried to fit in with my classmates as much as I could. I didn't really want to go eat Iranian food ever, except, I did want to, I just didn't want to admit it. But there was a really nice restaurant called the Kebab House when I was growing up. I feel like it was over on Ward Parkway. But when you're a child and you don't have to drive, you don't always pay attention to where things are. But I definitely kind of suppressed that part of my identity, even off through high school and maybe the first part of college. But when I got to college, I went to school at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, just outside St. Louis on the Illinois side of the border. And it was a bit more multicultural, and also being away from my family, I suddenly found myself embracing the Iranian part of myself a little more. I found a little Iranian grocery store and an Iranian restaurant in St. Louis, and I would get all the treats that I was missing from home. And I would occasionally put on Iranian dance music when I was working and when I had friends over, and kind of introduced people to the culture. I guess in some ways, in a strange way, I saw myself as an ambassador of Iranian culture, even though I didn't really know it that well, just because there was no one else there to do the job. And as I've gotten older and older, I've found myself more comfortable with it.
You know, there was no one else there to do the job, but this is the more multicultural setting. I mean, in high school, it doesn't sound like there was someone else there to do the job, but it sounds like also that might have been not as quite as safe feeling of a place to do it.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, if you stick out in high school, that's usually a death sentence.
Last time we talked about just young and old adult novels in general, but you were saying about your own experience that September 11th really changed people's interpretation in high school of your name, of your skin tone. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, I was a senior in high school when the September 11th attacks happened, and it quickly became apparent that the perpetrators were of Middle Eastern heritage. And because most people just see the entire Middle East as one homogenous region, there was little differentiation between any of the peoples and cultures. And so...
Let alone individuals within those countries and cultures.
Very true. And thankfully, my own experience was comparatively mild compared to the horror stories you would hear on the news about Muslims getting beaten up, about people with Middle Eastern sounding names getting harassed or attacked. I did get, flippantly called a terrorist more than once by other students. But I had my people, I had my group, my squad, and I was okay for the most part. I didn't have to face that alone.
You know it's okay not to be okay, right?
I have heard that. And also, as it as the narrative of those attacks and the aftermath played out in a weird way, it made me more willing and sometimes necessary to say, oh, I'm Iranian. We're not the bad guys in this one. Like, you're thinking of the hostage crisis, not 9/11. Like we're fine this time. Which, granted, I think Iran did get put in the axis of evil at some point as well. There is an Iranian comedian named Maz Jobrani who was part of a delightful axis of evil comedy tour in which it was him, an Iraqi comedian, and a Korean comedian. And that was some really funny stuff. But that's neither here nor there. But, yeah, in a weird way, it made me have to be a little more vocal about being Iranian, if only to kind of deflect a certain animosity.
But then in college, which would have been in those just years right after 9/11, where, I mean, it seems like the height of the kind of attitude that you're talking about would have been around then, like that your college right on the Illinois side of St. Louis was this more multicultural place, was this place where you were ready to be an ambassador of Iranian culture.
Yeah, I would say in a weird way, it did feel a little safer. And also just being older, no longer being a teenager, being a little more sure of myself, I also was of the attitude that people could just take me or leave me, and I wasn't going to be as timid or hide that part of myself anymore.
I want to talk to you about some of the details about Persian culture that I feel like I was learning from you in this book for the first time. There is a word that I don't want to mispronounce. It is spelled T-A-R-O-F, I think?
Tarof.
Yeah. What's that?
Tarof is a little bit hard to translate or define, but it is a sort of a system of cultural interactions. I once heard it loosely translated as debasing yourself to exalt others. And it governs hospitality and your interactions with other people. It's a reason if you ever meet an Iranian, they're probably going to offer you at least 3 times if you want anything to eat or drink. They will make an elaborate feast featuring several dishes. And then if you thank them, they'll say, oh, it was no trouble. I was already cooking it anyway. And it's this, I don't know, it's so hard to define when you haven't lived it. And even I, having lived it off and on whenever I'm with my family, sometimes have a hard time grasping the nuances of it.
Yeah, it sounds like you're also supposed to kind of decline the meal and say, oh, no, I couldn't.
It is, in fact, very important to decline a couple times before you finally accept.
And then there's Persian casual.
Yes. I'm not sure if this is a completely cultural thing or really just a my family thing. I suspect it's a little bit more cultural because other people have read it and been like, yeah, my family does that too. But yeah, people will tell you it's a casual occasion and you'll throw on like jeans and a t-shirt and you'll go and everyone will be in dress pants and button-up shirts. All the ladies will have gone and gotten their hair done and manicures and be quite a bit more formal than anyone led you to believe. And then you're sitting there in your casual clothes, feeling very out of place.
And soccer seems like a big deal for the kids, especially on Darius's fictional trip to Iran, where you've never been. But can you talk to, I mean, was your relationship with soccer a significant cultural thing for you?
Actually, no. Growing up, I was in youth soccer for like 2 years, and it turned out that I was more interested in like butterflies flapping by, and I was just extremely distractible. I was really, really bad at soccer.
You have also just described me in soccer.
Right. Like now that I'm older, I do appreciate it. I'm not super into it, but like if it's on, I'll watch it. And I actually would really like to go see a game at like the sporting stadium, but I still haven't made it out there, which is really embarrassing. Also, it's like really hot right now, so I don't want to go. It's like 100 degrees out. But soccer is the sport of Iran. For those who were watching the World Cup recently, Iranians were watching it very carefully. It's one of the more unifying things in the culture, both internally in Iran and also for the diaspora. everyone with even a little bit of an Iranian side to them is just obsessed with the Iranian national team. And so I found it a fascinating way to kind of explore what life would be like for a teenager in Iran.
There's a character, how would you pronounce his name? S-O-H-R-A-B.
Ah, Sohrab.
He is really into soccer, and he also, there's a food that he likes to eat that is like a mint syrup over romaine lettuce leaves.
Mm-hmm. Sikanja bean.
That sounds totally unimaginable to me. I cannot imagine what it tastes like to eat mint syrup on a lettuce leaf. Can you talk to me about this dish and just about the food part of identity for you?
I can. I've heard it said that food is such a big part of culture for most people, and I've also heard it said that food is culture. Iranians do take a lot of pride in the culinary lineage of Persian food. Family recipes are handed down generation to generation. If you ever get a chance to watch Anthony Bourdain's episode where he went to Iran, it's like really fantastic television. Growing up, it wasn't as big a thing at home, but whenever I visited my Iranian family, it was a big thing because we'd have all kinds of food. The family would all come together fairly frequently while we were visiting just because they didn't often get to see us. And it was a different idea of food because it was, even as my family was, as me and my sister were heading into being older kids and we didn't really have family dinner anymore, kind of my Iranian family did still do fairly large family dinners. And so it was, I don't know, I guess I started to kind of associate Iranian food with my family in that way, in that lots of love and time was given to the preparation. And that, boy, I feel like I just petered out right there.
No. I mean, you and your character share something in common, which is a love of tea. And a person can be from any culture and love tea. And it sounds like maybe you and Darius are both just like into it on your own. But it's also a way that the character connects with his Iranian family.
For sure. For as long as I can remember, when I was visiting any of my relatives, we often stayed with my dad's sister. I'd say most frequently we stayed with her. And the kettle was just always on from morning, when my grandmother would wake up at like 5 in the morning while the rest of the house was still asleep and put the kettle on to start boiling and make the first pot of tea. All day long, the kettle would be on. They'd toss out the pot eventually and make a new pot of tea, and it'd be ready for whenever anyone wanted one, with a snack or with a meal, or if anyone showed up at the door, they would have to sit down and have a cup of tea.
Well, we are going to take just one more break this morning in our portrait session with local author Adib Karam. His forthcoming book is Darius the Great Is Not Okay. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking to Adib Karam about his life and his new book, Darius the Great Is Not Okay. It's about being an awkward teenager with depression and a foreign-sounding name in a sea of what he calls the soulless minions of the orthodoxy.
The soulless minions of orthodoxy, yes.
Pardon me.
No, it's all good. As you mentioned, the book is replete with Star Trek references, and that actually is a Star Trek reference from an episode of Deep Space Nine in which a slightly paranoid character is convinced he's being hounded by the soulless minions of orthodoxy, and it stayed with me. It's a really delightful way of talking about some of the kids I went to high school with.
We've been talking about some of the aspects of Persian culture that that come up in the book. But one thing we haven't talked about yet is religion. And Darius grows up feeling like he's connected to the one other Iranian girl in school. And then he goes to Iran and finds that people who live in Iran are actually, there are all these distinctions between them that mean something to them, but mean nothing when you're members of a small minority here in the U.S.
Right. Definitely it was my experience growing up, and most Iranians that I've talked to felt the same, that if you're an Iranian living in America, it doesn't matter. If you're a Muslim, Jewish, Baha'i, Zoroastrian, Christian, whatever, you're Iranian, and that's what brings us together and binds us. But in Iran, things are quite different. The government of Iran is an Islamic republic, and Islam is the state religion, and the government is definitely harsher on some religious minorities than others. My own family is of Baha'i extraction. I myself am not Baha'i. I became atheist, I would say, right around my rebellious teenage years. But most of my family still is and is very deep in the faith. My uncle, who does live in Iran still, has been jailed on multiple occasions for practicing his faith. And so there's all these divisions there that don't exist, and yet the memories of those divisions still live in my dad's memory and his siblings, that they all have stories to tell about being bullied for being Baha'i when they were kids.
What are some of your dad's stories?
He's always a little hesitant to share because I think sometimes he's a little embarrassed. The one that always sticks with me a lot is that he and his older brother got in a lot of trouble because some kids started picking on them at school, throwing rocks at them and stuff. But it turns out he and my uncle were a little bit better at fighting, and they kind of beat the other kids up and got in a lot of trouble.
Well, can you talk to me more about the Baha'i faith itself?
Sure. It is a religion that was founded in Iran. The prophet that they follow is named Baha'u'llah, which translates to the glory of God. Boy, I sure hope it translates to the glory of God. I'm 90% certain. otherwise, I really just stuck my foot in my mouth really bad, and my dad will be so disappointed in me. But it is based on the tenets that God is progressively revealing his plan for mankind, and that Jesus Christ and Muhammad and Baha'u'llah are all part of a line of prophets leading all the way back to Abraham and Moses and the forefathers of mankind in the Old Testament. And that, as with the child learning new forms of math as they go through school, humankind is being taught new ways to live every few centuries by the word of God.
I mean, you've said that your uncle was jailed for practicing this faith. I mean, what is the day-to-day like for someone of Baha'i faith in Iran?
I can only say what I kind of have heard from my family or read about anecdotally. The government does see Baha'is as, oh, I don't remember the word, but basically apostates, basically, that they don't recognize it as a legitimate religion. They believe it's kind of an unauthorized offshoot of Islam. The Baha'i religion's headquarters are in Israel, and because of Iran's contentious relationship with Israel, there are sometimes accusations made that Baha'is are simply spies for Israel or Zionists. And so day-to-day, while they might not get bothered any, they might get harassed by government officials. My grandfather, my dad's father was beaten up and put in the hospital and had to, like, shut down his store when my dad was still pretty young growing up. My uncle, as I mentioned, has been in and out of jail for being kind of part of the leadership of his local community. There have been lots of complaints about human rights violations from the Baha'i leadership in the world leveled at the Iranian government.
You haven't been to Iran yourself, but when I read about it in your book, I feel like I am in another place and that you are the one who's taken me there. Did you have to do a ton of research, or is this a lifelong process of research and hearing stories and kind of piecing together a picture in your own mind?
I would say both. Having grown up surrounded with culture, looking at old family photos, hearing old family stories, there was definitely a lot of it that I was able to dredge up, but I also did a tremendous amount of research, especially on sort of what the day-to-day life would be like. It's so easy I think as Americans looking outward at the world, but also sometimes just as any human being looking at another human being, to forget that everyone is just living their life and that life goes on and that life is kind of the same no matter where you are. People have to get groceries or farm their food. People have to, you know, take showers. People have to live their lives.
Deal with grandparents' illnesses.
Yep. And so I didn't do a lot of research on kind of what the day-to-day life was like. Thank goodness for Google Street View as well, because while I had pictures of, like, my family's home and, like, the more scenic points of Yazd, like, I had no idea what kind of the streets looked like. So that's where Google Street View came in.
Do you think that you will ever go to Iran?
I think I know I would like to. And I don't feel like it's likely to happen while the relationship between the United States and Iran is the way it is.
Explain that?
Yeah. So as the child of a Baha'i family, there's kind of certain risks inherent in going back to Iran, especially since Baha'is are generally kind of discouraged from returning to Iran, especially if they've left, since there's people can then turn around and say, like, if the government treats you so bad, why are you going back?
When you say they can say that.
In presenting a legal case against, like, the human rights abuses, that then people would then say, well, if the human rights abuses are so bad, why are you going to visit your family there? Why aren't you staying away?
I see.
In addition to that, because the relationship between Iran and America has been so fraught, especially with the decertification of the nuclear deal, there's always the risk of being, A, denied entry, or B, being denied exit. There's numerous cases of Iranian Americans being detained. There was a journalist, Jason Rezaian, a few years ago, who was detained for a number of years. He was a correspondent for The Washington Post. Also, as a child of an Iranian, there's a part of me that doesn't really want to go back if I'm not going to go back with my dad. And he's not particularly keen on returning right now either, with the way things are.
You know, the character Darius, when he is feeling in Iran like he doesn't fit in there, which is sort of, I think, this double injury because he's coming from the U.S. where he also does not fit in. But he doesn't speak the language, and there are just some barriers for him. His friend reassures him, saying, you know, your place was empty before. Like, yeah, we all already know each other here, but you had a place here. It was just empty, and now you're filling it. Do you feel like you have an empty place in Iran?
I think to a certain extent, yes. But to a certain extent, no, in that I think you kind of have to want that place. And while I would love to see where my father grew up, and I would love to visit the family I still have there, with things the way they are, it doesn't call to my heart that much.
You know, your book, Darius the Great Is Not Okay, is getting tons of acclaim. And I wonder what that's like for you. I mean, are you surprised?
I am surprised and a little bit alarmed and and occasionally terrified that the other shoe is going to drop. When I was writing it, it really felt like I was writing it just for me. I was convinced that no one would ever want to publish it. And then when it sold and when I found out it was going to be a book, I was like, oh, wow, like people want to read it. And I have been overwhelmed and surprised. And I'm not sure why I'm so surprised, but a lot of people, not just Iranians, but lots of people who feel themselves torn between two cultures have connected with it in the way, I guess, that I hoped they would. And also a lot of parents who are parents of multiracial or biracial kids have said how much they enjoyed the insight into what it's like for their kids to be between two cultures.
Do you think that you're going to stay in Kansas City, or will you move to Portland like your main character? I'm stung a little that you had him living in Portland, I gotta say.
I was actually visiting the Pacific Northwest to visit my family in Vancouver, and then I have a friend in Seattle, and then my favorite tea store is in Portland. And so I was just kind of in that mindset when I was writing, and that just felt like the right place for Darius. While I love Portland, and if I ever become super wealthy, I might have like an apartment there or something out to go visit. I can't really see myself moving out of Kansas City. I was born and raised here. I love it here, even when it's 100 degrees out.
Has it grown friendlier for you than what you described in your teenage years?
It has. Part of that is me just being older and being more confident in myself and finding my friend group. And the city has changed a lot, especially the revitalization of downtown, the blossoming of arts and culture here with the Crossroads District coming up, and it has come up, like it's pretty freaking phenomenal now. And the Kauffman Center for Performing Arts is just absolutely gorgeous and is bringing all sorts of amazing, amazing cultural treasures to our city. The food, Iron Barbecue has always been amazing, but we have so many other great restaurants now. It's a nice place to live, and it's super affordable. That may sound a bit gauche to say, but like I talk to lots of writer friends who live in New York, and they're like, oh, I pay $1,200 a month for a closet. And they're like, oh, like, you know, I have a very nice apartment for that amount of money.
Yeah. The cover art on your book seems to be really personal for you. I've been following you on Twitter, and so I remember the day you tweeted out that you had seen the cover art, and you were ecstatic. And I wonder if you can talk about the meaning, but kind of describe the cover and then the meaning of it for you.
For sure. So the cover shows Darius and Sohrab. They spend a number of scenes in the novel on a little rooftop in a park overlooking the city of Yazd. And so the cover is basically looking over their backs or over their shoulders as they look out over the city. It's in really beautiful orange and teal colors. And it's a really accurate depiction of Yazd. It's awesome to see those two characters who had only ever lived in my mind suddenly shown in illustrated form. And it felt almost magical in a way to see my father's hometown on the cover of a book, to see my family's heritage presented not just to me, but then to know that a whole bunch of people are going to see it.
And kind of through your eyes.
Through my eyes, for sure, yeah.
Adib Karam, thank you so much, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Adib's giving a reading on August 30th at Rainy Day Books. That's the official launch event. And you can find out more about it on the Rainy Day website. You can listen back to this conversation or grab the link to share it at kcur.org/centralstandard. Adib's story will be paired with photographic portraits by the talented Paul Andrews, who's been collaborating with us on this entire series. And by the way, congratulations, Paul, on becoming a proud father. Hooray! I'm sure the photos of that baby are gorgeous. Central Standard's portrait sessions are in-depth interviews with some of the most interesting people in Kansas City. If you have an idea of someone we should turn the lens on next, shoot us an email. We're centralstandard@kcur.org. The weekend is here, but you can talk to us on Twitter anytime, @kcurcst. And that's a wrap. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Suzanne Hogan, Koi Duggar, Jen Chen, Matthew Long Middleton, and Sylvia Maria Gross, with help from intern Trevor Hook. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.